The title of the shiur, as you could see, is longer. And in English, it's also kind of bland. The title that I'm going to put up on YU Torah is going to be Katonti or Katonti, right? And it all revolves around one word at the beginning of this week's parsha. And I'm using it as an opportunity to introduce you to some of the history of what we call Tameh HaMikra. And so if you take a look at it, you'll see on the handout, which I hopefully you all got, you will see that there is one word that I've made big in green to make it identifiable, and it is the word katonti. Now, a little background of what's happening, because without context, it doesn't make sense. Yaakov is on his way back to Israel after being gone for X amount of years. What the X is something that, you know, is debatable, but at least two decades. And he left because he's running away from Esav. As he comes back, he finds out that Esav's coming to meet him with 400 men, which he interprets, understandably, as a threat. And he goes into action, and he does three things. The three things he does is an escape plan, prayer, and tribute. All right? And the prayer part is here. It's funny because the Midrash says that he prepared for three things. One is the milchama. He didn't prepare for milchama at all. He divided the camp so that if Esav, he prepared to be on the receiving end of milchama and to escape. And his prayer goes as follows in Pasuk Yod, Elohe Avi Avraham, Elohe Avi Yitzchak, he addresses God, Adonai Ha'omer Elai, Shuv Li'artzecha U'Molatecha Ve'tiva Imach. Now, I didn't put any translations here because translation is not the issue here. On the other hand, translation is the entire issue, and I didn't want to slant anything by putting a translation in. So either way, there's no translation on this page. Now, he said, God who told me that I have to go back. So you now expect Yaakov to turn around and say, you told me to come back. What, you told me to come back so I could walk into an ambush? What's that about? Instead, he says, Katonti, mikol ha-chasadim, mikol ha-emet, asher asit et avdecha. All right, so katonti could mean I am small or I have become small. It could be interpreted either way. Now, if we interpret it the first way, I am small, then that means the mem of Mikol HaChasadim becomes what we call mem hayitaron, comparative mem, which we're very familiar with throughout Tanakh. And it means I am smaller than all of the greatnesses you've done for me, which means essentially I'm not worthy of all the kind things you've done for me. Right? Okay. Katonti Mikol HaChasadim Mikol HaEmet, asher asit et avdecha. And so he comes to Hashem and he says, I'm not worthy of all the greatness you've given to me. I crossed the Euphrates, or crossed this Jordan with just a stick. And on the way back now, I have two full camps, right? And now I'm afraid Esav's going to kill me. That's one way to read it. The other way to read it is Mem HaSibah. Now, let me give you an example, but by the way, of Mem Hayitaron. As an example, we say, it's very common, we say, Tov Shem Mishem and Tov. Oil is better, a good name is better than good oil. Tov Shem Mishem and Tov. And then in Kohelet Perek Zion, there's a whole series of these relative Tovs. This is better than that. And that's with Mem Ashvar, Mem Yitaron, Mem that operates as a comparative. This is more than that. This is bigger than that. Ani gadol mimcha, I am greater than you, etc. That Mem. But there's a Mem that is a Mem of cause, in which we would read Katonti as not I am small, but I have become small. And then you would read Katonti mikol achasadim mikol amet, I have become small as a result of all of the kindnesses that you've done for me.
Does it also mean I'm humbled?
Well, you do the exact same thing in English. Perfect, Dave. You could either say I'm humble or humbled. In other words, either I am too humble, meaning I'm not worthy of all the great things, or I've become unworthy as a result of the great things. Right? So you'd sort of play it the same way, adding the D into that word. And by the way, you'll find that this is actually a machloket, Rashi and Ramban, on how to read the Pasuk. Rashi here in source 4 says as follows, Katamtu mikol ha-chasadim, nitma'atu zechuyotai, al yedei ha-chasadim v'amet shasita imi. My zechuyot have lessened. In other words, I had a certain amount of great merit. And perhaps Yaakov is even saying in this take that when I left Israel, I had great merit of taking care of father's flock, of being loyal to mother, whatever great merit. And that's why you appeared to me and you said to me, I'll protect you and everything else. But now you've given me so many things that I've become small and I'm no longer worthy of it. I've lost my merits. The merits got used up with all those gifts. And therefore, therefore I'm afraid that now the original promise of I'll protect you has been used up. And Rashi throws in another piece, which is from a different Midrashic trope, which is that any promise God gives you that's good, you have to worry at a later point whether or not you're still worthy of that promise. Are you the same person that you were when you were given the promise, or Shemi Yigrom Achet? And that's a sugya in Midrashit. It's also the beginning of Masechet Brachot. That's Rashi's take, right? And the Mizrahi, Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi, one of the foremost, one of the two top super commentaries on Rashi, in his comment, says that the mem of Mikol HaChasadim is like the mem of Chalchlili Einayim Miyayin, that my eyes have become bloodshot from wine. It's what we call mem hasiba, Risan Mistibatayin. So he's just explaining that there's such a mem that is the cause, the not causative, but it's mem of cause. All right, that's the Rashi. On the other hand, you have the Ramban. And the Ramban says the following. The first thing he does is, as the Ramban almost always does, is he quotes Rashi. I put it in small print because we already saw it. And then he says his own piece, which is, Ve'einenu nachon b'lashon hakatuv. The Ramban says that's not the way the text talks. V'yod k'amarch re'chein v'atamarte t'vitimach. How could Yaakov possibly thinking that he's no longer worthy of that honor, of that protection, when the next line in the prayer is, you told me you're going to be good to me, which means he's calling on the original bracha, and he's not assuming that he's lost that zchut. The Ramban asks. So he said, how could you think that Yaakov is concerned that his station has dropped as a result of having given all these great gifts, and now he's no longer worthy? He invokes that same bracha next. Yaakov invokes the two promises, one given to him at Beit El X amount of years earlier with the vision, and one in Haran just before he left, when God appeared to him and said, go back. First he said, he invoked what God told him in Haran, which is, God, you told me to go back. Right, and then now, by the way, notice that Yaakov says, you're the one who told me to go back and I'll be good with you. And by the way, since that point, there's been no blessing that's noticeable. Yaakov left then, so that's just recently. So what's Yaakov afraid that he's lost Tzchuyot? That's the Ramban's attack on Rashi, a three-pronged attack. Then he comes up with his own approach, which is understandable. Aval katonti, katonti doesn't mean I've become small, but I am small. It's a series of requests on the part of Amos when he sees a vision. Meaning that Yaakov is not able to stand up to that. That's what that means in that context. In the Midrash, Rabbi Abba says, what is katonti? I'm not worthy. Chasadim, etc. And it goes on. That's the Ramban. Okay? Now, an example of that is in this pasuk in Rut, when Naomi tells the girls to leave and to go back. They refuse and they stay with her. And then she turns around, she gets kind of angry with them. And he says, Shovnam no tai lechna. My daughters, leave me. Ki zakanti miot leish. The scenario that Naomi is sort of imagining, Ruth and Orpah picturing, is that Naomi has more sons, and they'll marry one of those sons. And the idea is that she says to them, I mean, that's not what they're thinking at all, because it's nuts, but that Naomi's saying, that even if tonight I were to be with a man and I was to have kids and I had sons. So you're going to wait around for all those years till those sons grow up to have yibum with them, et cetera. All right, that's not what they have in mind, but that's what she kind of puts to them. Now, the way she presents it is zakanti miot liish, which means not I've always been too old for a man. All right, she was married. She had two sons. It means I have become too old, right? I'm too old miot liish, right? So the mem there is a mem of cause. I've become too old that I can no longer be with a man. Right, and that actually supports Rashi's position. So you could put it either way. Now, the reason I bring this whole thing up and this big word, one single word, katonti, is because if you look back here at our text with the green letter, you will see how most printed chumashim present the word katonti, and you see the little apostrophe on top, little hook on top, which we call a gerish. I'll introduce the whole thing to you. We call it a gerish. And it's commonly read in Ashkenazi world, katonti. And you probably heard that Monday. You'll probably hear it tomorrow morning. Katonti. And if you take a look over here on the Leningrad Codex, which is the oldest and most reliable full codex we have of Tanakh. Remember, the Aleppo Codex, we have very little of Chumash. If you look in the Aleppo, in the Leningrad Codex, you can see katonti is marked with a geresh. It's kind of faint. I highlighted the word, but there is a gerish there. That's the way it's read. Okay. Surprise, surprise, you open up a Koran Tanakh, one of the most popular Tanakhim around today, and you will find that it's pointed a little differently. And it looks like this. It has a reviyah, the little diamond over it, which would be read katonti. Now, the cancellation is not the issue, as you will see. But it's written that way, and it's based on the Heidenheim Wolf Heidenheim's Chumash, which was printed in Redelheim in 1818. And you got to wonder. The Aleppo Codex, from all the information we have, all the reports, has the Gerish. The Leningrad Codex we see as the Gerish. All the reliable books have a Gerish. Where did this come from? So the answer is, if you look back a little further, you can find in the Yemenite manuscripts of the Torah, and here is an example from the Tafsir, that's of Sanya Gaon's translation into Arabic, you could see the way they have the text is katonti with the revi'ah. So there is some sort of tradition of that. And Ginsberg, in his famous huge work on the Masoretic text, has the geresh, and then says, and other texts have a revi'ah. By the way, and this is telling, I produced for you here in number three, that's all in that text, the unklus, the Targum into Aramaic, and the translation into Arabic, which was the Sadi Gaon's translation, the Tafsir, on the Chumash. Ah, Uncle says, Ze'erin zachvati mikol chastin mikol tavan. My zuchuyot are small from all of the kindness. His Targum seems to follow Rashi's direction. I have become lessened as a result. But interesting, in the Arabic, ana ekal seems to be saying, I am smaller than, it seems to be supporting the Ramban's take. And there are two very different takes on what this word means. Is it, I am not worthy of, I've never been worthy of, I'm unworthy of all the greatness, or I have become unworthy as a result, which, by the way, reflects a huge theological divide. Because think about it. Does a person say, I am who I am, God gives me gifts, and I deserve those gifts, but I kind of lose my merits, and as a result of that, now I'm no longer worthy of gifts, which is one way things work, which is to say that every time you get some sort of a gift in this world, it chips away at your zchuyot.
Why is
on
that?
On the other hand, we have the other position, which is to say, I'm just not worthy of this. These things are greater than me. And it may be just the classic humility, or maybe an honest feeling of being overwhelmed by God's kindness. Very different take.
Just to clarify, why would all the kindnesses end up diminishing one's worth?
Oh, very good. So it cuts to a much larger issue that deserves its own share, but I want to touch on it briefly, is part of what happens in the early part of the post-destruction period is something that may have always been there, may have never been there, I don't know, but we never hear it explicit until this period, is the notion of all the rewards, because if you look in the Tanakh, in Torah, and you see the rewards that are promised for people who do good things, and the punishment that's promised if the people stray, it is all this worldly. The blessing, look in Dvarim Zion, for instance, the blessing for being loyal to God's mitzvot is that God will give you lots of children and give you lots of crops, and God will make sure that nobody in your family miscarries, all of those great blessings. And the similar thing is on the opposite side. If you stray, then you'll be exiled, et cetera, et cetera. What happens post-destruction is there's a whole different theology that at least becomes explicit at that point. And I can sum it up with one story. There's a story at the end of the first parak of Kiddushin that is one of the versions of why Elisha ben Avuya went off the path and became what we call Acher, the other. And the story is that he saw a father tell his son, go up to the top of that tree, send the mother bird away and collect the chicks and bring them to me. The two mitzvot in the Torah that the Torah promises a long life for, honoring your parents and shiluach haken. Mm-hmm. The kid goes up, sends the mother away, takes the chicks, and on the way falls down and dies. And Elisha ben Avuya says, where is this guy's long life? And then he leaves Judea. I mean, that's one version of the story. And the Gemara then says, had he understood the famous drasha of Rabbi Yaakov, he wouldn't have left. Why? What does Rabbi Yaakov say? What does it mean you'll have a long life in the eternal life? In other words, all of those promises now become promises about the hereafter. And then what another piece of that puzzle is, that whenever, let's say, there is somebody who is worthy, but not completely worthy in this world, God gives him a good life. God gives him a bad life, sorry. And the suffering that he incurs, that kind of gives him the complete good picture in the world to come. And vice versa, you have a bad guy who has a good life. Why is that? Because he's not completely bad. So God pays him off in this world. And then God can give him a clean black slate in the world to come. All right. And there's a lot more details to that, but that's kind of the broad picture. So fitting in with that, you would have the notion that if I got all this good stuff, that must have eaten away at my zchuyot. And now maybe I'm not as worthy as I was X amount of years ago when God promised protection. Maybe I want a protection now. That's the thinking underneath it. Hmm. But what I want to introduce you to is something that will sound very mechanical, very dry. I'll try to make it not dry, but something which is actually core to our understanding of the Torah. You take a look at the text that you have in front of you, whether or not it's the text that I replicated and made some letters bigger in different color, or the text that I got from the Leningrad Codex and put in, and you'll see that the text looks nothing like what a Sefer Torah looks like. A Sefer Torah has letters and spaces, and that's it. There are small spaces between words, and there are larger spaces between paragraphs, sometimes as much as the whole line, sometimes a few spaces between paragraphs. That's it. There are no vowels. There are no cantillation marks. You don't know where the end of a pasuk is. Okay. So how could anybody read the Torah and understand what it's saying? The answer is very straight, that there is an oral tradition. An oral tradition which teaches you not only what a particular letter sounds like, recognizing letters, to tells you that when certain letters come together, here are the vowels that you should assume. There are no vowels in Hebrew. So here are the vowels, and there's no marked vowels. So here are the vowels that you should apply to them, and therefore this is what the word should sound like. There's a whole other part of Torah Shebaal Peh that tells you what the word means. And then there's another larger piece, which is, now that you know what all the words sound like, here's how the syntax of this sentence works so that you read it correctly and end up with the proper meaning. And there are loads of examples of sentences that when you read them in, with the improper syntax or improper punctuation, you end up with a very different meaning. And I'll give you one great example, which is popular and a popular mistake. Vayered Adonai B'anan is when God is coming to forgive Bnei Israel after the Egel. Vayitzev Imosham, God came down in a cloud. Moshe stood there with him. Vayikra, now what are the next three words? Vayikra, B'shem Adonai. How do you parse that? Do you read it Vayikra, B'shem Adonai, or do you read Vayikra, B'shem Adonai? And what's the difference? The difference is, who's the subject of the clause? He called out in Hashem's name would mean Moshe's calling. And that means Moshe's the one who's saying, Adonai, Adonai, El Rachum, Mechanun, etc. Or is it God who's speaking, in which case the phrasing should be Vayikra B'Shem, who called out? Adonai. So who's the subject here? Is it Moshe or God? And who therefore is declaring the Midot of Rachamim? And that makes a big difference. And so the pausing makes a huge difference. Now, that was all Baal Peh. And it remained all Baal Peh throughout the rabbinic period, meaning the Gemara is familiar with the idea of there being punctuation, of there being vowels, but there's no graphic markings for them. What happens is immediately after the rabbinic period, I'm being loose with that phrase, but beginning in the 6th century, which is after all of the identifiably named people in the Gemara are no longer alive. I'm not going to say the Gemara is finished then, because not really. But at that period, there is a project that gets underway simultaneously in Tiberias and in Babylonia. And it's a project that we would call the Masoretic Enterprise. And the purpose of this project is to maintain and clarify and ultimately publish a perfect Tanakh. A Tanakh that reflects the proper vowels and the proper syntax and a bunch of other details. And to do that, we have all these oral traditions that they then have to figure out how to make markings for so that we'll be able to recognize. So the first thing they came up with was markings that indicate vowels. And so you look at the word katonti right here, and you see a little T under the kuf. You see a dot over the tet. You see two dots under the nun. You see another dot under the tav. And then you know to read katonti, and not katanti, and not katantai, and not katnuti, katonti. You know how to read it. And those are called nikudot. Now, what we use is the Tiberian nikudot. In Babylonia, they had nikudot, which were somewhat similar, but they put them on top of the letters. I could show you an example of it. We have documents, we have manuscripts that were used, Babylonian Nikud, where they had the Nikudot on top of the letters. Almost all of our Nikudot are under the letters. That's the Tiberian way, and that's what we accepted. They also set up a system of punctuation, of punctuation marks that would allow you to see how you should break a sentence up, where a sentence ended, and how you break it up. And those marks are called the Ta'amei HaMikra. And here, a few rules about Ta'amei HaMikra. Every single word in Tanakh has one and only one ta'am, and there's a few exceptions. A few exceptions of words that have two. There are no words that have none. Every word has a ta'am on it. So the ta'am on, for instance, the word after katonti, right there, is that little arrow under the chaf. The ta'am on the word chasadim is the apostrophe hanging over after the mem. The tam on hemet is the two dots above the mem. Now, the puncture, these marks serve three important purposes. The first most important purpose is punctuation. That's going to be our focus today. A second purpose is stress. It tells you where to stress the word. So, for instance, this word is katonti because the stress is on the tav, on the tet, because the trope mark is on the tet, katonti, and not katonti, which, by the way, would change its meaning. Mikol ha-chasadim u-mikol ha-emet. But asher asita, and not asher asita, et avdecha. And by the way, this has huge implications because there are words that if you read them properly, they mean one thing. And if you read them improperly, they change the tense. So for instance, asita is you did. Asita would be you will do. And that doesn't make sense in this context. Yaakov's thanking God for the things he's done for him. Okay. Kiva makli avarti atayardain. Avarti, I passed. Avarti, I will pass. Well, he didn't pass it yet. Doesn't make sense. Right? And this is a common thing, way more common than we're used to. Once you notice it, you start noticing it all the time. Okay. But the third thing, which is the least significant, is cantillation. It's important, but it's the least significant because even if you didn't chant the words correctly, if you said them correctly and punctuated correctly, then it's not ideal, but it's still a proper Kriyat HaTorah. If you pronounce them incorrectly, obviously, or even if the syntax is wrong, you may actually have to go back and read it again. Okay. But I want to talk about the punctuation. And what I'm going to show you is this chart at the bottom. This is a chart. There's a lot of different charts available of Tamei HaMikra. Now, the Rishonim gave them names. They gave them names. And the way to imagine it is that the Pasuk is an empire. And the empire is governed by a Caesar, a Caesar. So the whole empire is governed by the Caesar. And the Caesar, by the way, the governor is always at the end of the empire. So there's a Sof Pasuk. Sof Pasuk that looks like under the Nun of Machanot right there. That line, that's a Sof Pasuk. You'll find one at the end of every Pasuk in Tanakh. Every Pasuk has a Sof Pasuk. However, if the empire is very large, he has to send a fellow Caesar to cover the first half. And that fellow Caesar is what we call an etnachta. So you take a look here under the word avdecha, and you see the etnachta. It's an upside-down wishbone. So the Pasuk reads, katonti mikol ha-chasidim mikol ha-emet asher asita et avdecha, kiv makli avarti t'aden hazev atayiti l'shvei machanot. And that nachta does not divide the pasuk size-wise, it divides it idea-wise. So that almost every pasuk that's longer than five words will have an nachta because there's two ideas there. Who spoke, what he said. What he said, what he answered. What I'm going to do, and here's why. What I did and how many. What time it was and what he said. There's always going to be two sub-ideas there. That's the nachta. Then when you go further down, you have more minor pauses. So you have the Malachim, which are pauses. You have the Mishnim, which are more minor pauses. Then you have the Shalishim, which are the smallest pause. And then all the rest of them are Mishartim, which means they connect. They're not a pause, they connect with the next word. We can do a whole shiur on Tamei HaMikra. This is just an intro to whet your appetite. But I want to show you that the two trope marks that we're dealing with here, which are the Geresh and the Riviyah, are not of the same level of pause. The Riviyah is a third level pause. The Geresh is a fourth level pause. Who cares? The answer is that we care in understanding the Pasuk. I'm reading the Pasuk the way it's read in most shuls. Katonti. It's a very brief pause. Mikol HaChasidim, which means it's not that broken from the next word. Which means katonti mikol hachasadim may very likely mean that I am not worthy of, and the mem is a mem ha yitaron. I am smaller than, right? However, if I read it this way with the riviyah, it's more of a break. Katonti, from what? Mikol hachasadim, which means I have become small as a result of the chesed. In other words, these two traditions, which are as small as a dot or an apostrophe, may reflect two different understandings of what Yaakov's saying. Either Yaakov's saying, I am too small, I'm not worthy of all this kindness. Or he may be saying, I have become unworthy as a result of the kindness. And that the Riviyah may be reflecting Rashi's read. Now, we don't have Rashi's Chumash. We don't know whether Rashi had a Riviyah or a Geresh. But I think that the Rashi's read reflects the Riviyah. The stronger break, I become small. From what? From kol hachasadim, kol haemet. And so it's very possible that the two different traditions that we have about the very technical issue of the trop mark actually reflect two different understandings of what's going on in this pasuk. And as a result of that, we're either making a larger or a smaller pause to try to set the mem of mikol hachasadim in a different place. Is mem part of the flow? I have become small. I'm smaller than all of the chasadim. Or is it a greater break? I have become small as a result of the chasadim, and a very different theological perspective. So imagine that our understanding of how God deals with us and how God rewards us and reckons and maintains promises may be based on how we read this pasuk, how much of a break we make, and that's reflected in the Ta'amei HaMikra. Now, this is just a guesstimate. I have nothing better to back this up than the fact that there's these two traditions on the word katonti, and there's two different interpretive traditions about what Yaakov's saying. And then I think that they could be aligned, possibly, and to reflect them back together that way. So it's just...
Rabbi, I have the Koran in front of me.
Right. And you have a Reviyah.
It's got the, I guess, what you referred to as the harder break.
Right, exactly, right.
Yeah, but interestingly, in the English translation, it says, I am unworthy of all the kindnesses.
Right.
Not I have become unworthy because of.
Right. So I don't know which translation Koren used in their English work. I don't know. That's first of all. Second of all, it's very likely that whoever's working on Koren, my question, and I asked this of somebody, but I didn't get an answer yet, of somebody who was involved in the decision in Koren of which manuscript to use. It could be that they were not familiar with what I'm suggesting here. And would say that, you know, the Revi'ah is based on extra tradition. We may not have any different meaning than a Gerash, and we prefer the translation of Ramban. By the way, the Ramban's translation seems to be, at least for us, more comfortable to what Yaakov's saying. To think that Yaakov's saying, I was worthy then, but you gave me so much stuff, I'm not worthy now, seems a little weaker than saying the typical humility of saying, you've given me great stuff and I'm not worthy of it, which is what's reflected there. So I don't know that we can necessarily line up Koren's translation with Koren's trope.
Okay,
good. All right, so now.
Why do you refer to as Revi'ah?
Oh, that's the technical name that you find in most of the handbooks. We call it a Revi'i, right?
Revi'i, yeah.
The one thing that we know that both of them have in common is it's four-sided, and it reflects that you're supposed to have four notes. Da-da-da-da, and it goes down. But some call it Revi'ah, some call it, by the way, some people call it Etnach, and some call it Enachta. And some call it Sof Pasuk, and some call it Siluk. As long as we know which thing we're looking at, so the nomenclature is not that significant. By the way, there's a whole science of this. And one of the things that Mordechai Breuer, Alav Shalom, was an expert in was in Ta'amei HaMikra. He wrote the book on Ta'amei HaMikra, actually bought it from him, which is one of those cool things you do in Israel. You go find somebody who wrote a great book, and you go to their house, and you buy it from him, and you get them to sign it, and then, you know, it's very cool. But anyhow... but there are people who made a career out of the issue of Ta'amei HaMikra, and of teaching it and formalizing it. Okay, so next week we're going to do something on Hanukkah, even though it'll be a couple days before Hanukkah, because the week after that, even though it's going to be still Hanukkah, I got to do Miketz, because this is the first time in 20 years that Miketz is coming not on Hanukkah, which means that we get that special Miketz Haftarah that shows up once in a Yovel, basically. All right. And so we're going to do that. So next week, Yiras Hashem, we'll do a Hanukkah piece. And then and the one after that, we'll do Shlomo's wisdom in the story of the three women and the baby. Okay. Everybody stay healthy. And
can I call you later?
Yeah, that'd be great.